This is Rusty Tanton.
And Amber Ray.
And you're listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network, the show focused on all things Atlanta and sometimes elsewhere.
It's November 30th, 2007, and we are here with
Dave Kaufman.
And he is the author of Peachtree Creek. So first off, why don't you just tell us a little bit about the book?
Well, the book is a culmination of a lot of work, a lot of varied interests. I bumped into Peachtree Creek when I first moved to Atlanta in 71 and saw some of the relics down at the old Decatur Waterworks. And it was kind of intriguing as a kid, and later came back and was, at that point in my life, I'd gotten into whitewater canoeing and photography and also exploration. And so I kind of bumped into Peachtree Creek again, seeing it cross under Claremont or Peachtree, and then going back and kind of exploring it, and one thing led to another, and I want to find out where it went to and where it came from and what the history was, and I started asking around, nobody seemed to know. Yeah, so.
So what made you decide to canoe the whole thing, and when you started, did you have the intent of compiling it all into a book, or were you just doing it for yourself?
Yeah, I was pretty naive, so I started with a book concept early, and kind of mushroomed from there. But the canoeing was certainly a piece, but again, you know, the hobbies that it embraced. I've always been drawn to flowing water, usually cleaner than this, but I probably learned more about that after the fact than before.
Yeah.
And so canoeing, it was just a great way to see it firsthand. I mean, you could get into places you couldn't get into anywhere else, any other way.
And it took you, 15 years to do this?
Yeah, I started in 1990, and I really finished it by 2000. And during the period, that period, I picked it up and I put it down and said, this is ridiculous, nobody's ever going to be interested in this. said, well, I've got this far, I'll pick it up again. Kept pushing forward like that. So it was pretty much finished in 2000. And then from 2000 to 2007, I went through three different publishers, finally landing UGA, which turned out to be the best one. High quality academic press. But the publishing cycle is very slow. So, and through that last 7 years, there were a couple of, I had to go back and update a number of things, obviously.
Right. Yeah, I noticed in the book there are some things that, like, you have a picture from the early 90s and then now, and it's totally changed.
Well, that's been one interesting thing is I can actually see some of the history evolving since I started. One real eye-opener, I guess you'd call it, is seeing a railroad stanchion from the mid-1800s Richmond and Danville Railway that was in Peachtree Creek when I started, and about a year later it fell over. It's kind of like this moment in time.
You mentioned in the book that the creek can be really dangerous, and the water can get going really fast, and did you ever run into any problems? I mean, I know that you said you tried to, pick days when the rainfall had been just right or whatever, but were there any times when you were kind of scared?
As far as the water goes, not really. I was pretty careful about when I got into it. I kind of understood the fall-off characteristics and at least the majority of the obstacles. In my case, no, but as I wrote about in the book, others haven't been so lucky. People that have seen it and gone, oh boy, I want to jump in that. And they hit it at flood stage and go down and find out, there's a bridge or barbed wire fence or sewer pipe. And it's, those kinds of things actually be much more dangerous in white water because there's you don't really have the eddies that you have in a white water river. And you also have all sorts of man-made obstacles.
Did you run into any ruins or anything along the way that you just had no idea to expect?
Yeah, I think I found the, you know, obviously the Decatur Waterworks is something that's still there, but things like timbers in the creek from the original Howell Mill Bridge, covered bridge, and some timbers in the bank that could have been from the mill itself. So little pieces of history that were really satisfying to find.
And that was my favorite thing about the book, honestly, is that how it ties into just Atlanta history overall. And, you know, there are little stories here and there about, you know, this person and the mill that he built and the significance it had. And, so I think it's really interesting because these are things that probably even a lot of people who live in Atlanta just have lost touch with a lot of history. And it's sort of right underneath us.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly things like that are forgotten. And this book has had a lot of appeal, you know, both to what's called the old guard that have been around Atlanta. They've seen some of these things, but never really had all the pieces. So that's put that together for them. And then a lot of kind of the hidden Atlanta, you know, some of the homeless issues, the pollution issues, things like that, that kind of has struck a more environmental and change-oriented audience.
And you mentioned in the, towards the end that November of 2007 was the deadline for, and I might get it wrong, so you better tell me what it is.
Sure.
Like some SOAR compliance or something?
Yeah, the city has two mandates. They're called consent decrees. The first one was for consolidated sewer overflow cleanup, and then the second one's for sanitary sewer. Consolidated sewer was supposed to end in 2007. They bumped it out a year, so they have an extension, but all parties have agreed to that in the process. And they've made quite a bit of progress. The fact that they're only a year late is amazing to me.
Yeah, because I was wondering about that when I was reading. I was like, oh, they're supposed to be done with that now? I wonder how that's going.
Yeah, how did that work out?
I give Mayor Franklin and her regime, you know, high marks for jumping on that. And you know, the city of Atlanta for ponying up the $3 billion it's going to take overall.
Yeah, right. That's no joke.
Well, but it's got to be done. I mean, I was kind of shocked, and I think maybe a lot of people would be, to read some of the stuff about just how bad the sewer system has been here. And I mean, I know that Atlanta's had sewer problems. I knew that, but I didn't know particulars. And I think maybe sometimes, you know, when we live in cities, we just kind of expect that, oh, well, it's, you know, it's a modern city. Obviously, the sewer system
is. Of course, I'll be able to flush my toilet.
And then when I read about, like, you know, this open river of sewage flowing through Piedmont Park. It's like, are you kidding me? What?
It's like, is this a third world country?
What year is this?
Hey, I want to clarify, that's only if there was a tenth of an inch of rain or more.
Oh,
that's all.
That's okay.
Yeah, which I guess we don't have to worry about that much lately.
This is true.
Yeah.
But and thankfully, all that's been plowed underground, and it still is not the optimal solution, but it's better.
Is this a kind of problem that a lot of cities face, or is this kind of unique to Atlanta?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's very much a study in urban evolution, and it's not uncharacteristic of cities literally across the world, certainly in America. Atlanta is unique on a couple of, technically it's unique because it's got a fairly steep runoff or gradient when you come to the city. So that creates, you know, these periods of rains of high flows you've got to deal with. And there are variables, but yes, same thing. You know, Chicago went through this. They used to dump their sewage into Lake Michigan. They kept moving their intake. They moved it out 2 miles and they're still poisoning themselves. So there's, you know, cities evolve. This is something that typically isn't high on the priority list until people start dealing over.
Yeah, and it's crazy to me because, I mean, it's such a basic thing. Like, this infrastructure is, like, basic and fundamental to a city, but I think some reason, yeah, people don't think about it until it's a disaster.
Well, I think it's a very good point. It's a kind of a comment on our society as we've been disconnected from these basic things and are more, you know, we find the things that we've created to become more important. Commerce becomes more important than these kinds of things. You know, the day-to-day culture that we've built, the TV, car, all the things that you're engaged with daily, you think you can never do without.
Yeah. Well, there is sort of, I mean, there is a pattern with just not addressing things until they're disasters. I mean, look at our transportation situation around here. I mean, that's a whole other podcast waiting to be done.
Water, transportation, sewage. Well, at least the sewage, you've got a head start.
Yeah. Do you think that with all the development that's been going on in the Atlanta area, knowing what you know about the way the water system works around here, do you see that being coming to like some kind of crisis level, or do you think it'll be okay?
No, I think it's. I think we've got to make some changes, particularly in. I don't think we can sustain the level of development or the projections for development that the city has on the water resources we have. There's efforts underway to say pull water from other watersheds, which you know maybe that's a possibility. I think just taking a good hard look at development and saying where do we want to be 100 years down the road instead of where we want to be in 3 years, would be a good approach.
Do you think building extra reservoirs would be helpful, or do you think that's kind of a band-aid?
No, it's a reservoir. So Lake Lanier is an engineered solution.
Yeah,
that's basically capturing and storing water that otherwise you might not have been able to. So you know, when there's lots of rain, you're able to store it. If there's little rain, you can draw down on it.
Yep.
What we're seeing now is that we're exceeding the steady state capacity, if you will. So more reservoirs, I don't think we're going to solve that.
Yeah.
I mean, they may, in a very local area, provide that area with water that may have gone into a bigger reservoir somewhere else. So unless, again, we can find new sources of water in the Tennessee watershed or conservation, reduce the average intake per person.
Even conservation, I'll get that word right eventually.
Okay.
Even conservation, though, I mean, doesn't that really only account, can't you really only realistically conserve maybe 15 or 20% more water than what we're dealing with now? Even if you have like a gray water solution in your house or something like that, I mean, how much is that really going to help?
Well, so I haven't looked at the actual numbers, but I could say that, you know, 100 years ago, and I think there were some numbers in the book, that when we went from something like 25 gallons per person per day to 150, maybe that may have been as short as those, more as recent as the 70s.
Yeah.
I might want to go back and check that for you.
I think that was it, because I just finished reading it a few days ago. I think that was it.
So just caveat, that might not be the exact number, but point
something
being,
like that.
It's something
so,
like that.
So given our current lifestyle, you're merely conserving on that scale, I agree. I think there are ways to use less water on a more meaningful level, but it would be some lifestyle changes.
Yeah.
And whether conservation in and of itself is a big enough solution, especially in light of the growth that the city would like to see.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my understanding of Atlanta versus other regions is that other regions have a much bigger water supply to tap versus Atlanta, and so really the only...
Not necessarily, because doesn't California and like the West have not so much water, but they bring it...
Well, for L.A., for example, it's, you know, one of the first deals where they went up in the mountains, took the water from that area, piped it down to L.A. I mean, L.A. to me is an irrigated desert.
Yeah.
You know? So, I guess it depends. You probably have areas that have more water than they could ever use. Same thing.
So it's not, because I was wondering, I mean, how much of it is that there's just too many people and not enough water, and how much of it is, you know, there's plenty of water, it's just not being managed well.
Good question. I don't know.
I guess nobody really knows.
Well, I think we're seeing in Atlanta that there isn't enough water. But, you know, we can manage it better, but we still have to look at the future uses and growth.
Well, tying it in with the book, I just, as I was reading, I thought it was interesting because you were talking about how, like, starting in the late 19th century, different water facilities were built along Peachtree Creek in different locations, and how some of them, you know, practically as soon as they were built, they were already obsolete.
Right.
And it seems like, I just wonder, like, how much of the type of growth they were experiencing at that time parallels the growth we're experiencing now, and were they just not planning far enough ahead, just that kind of thing.
I'd say that the growth they were experiencing then was small in comparison to what we're seeing now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for a number of reasons, technology, transportation, all those things, telecommuting, communication. So now we've facilitated sprawl on a level that could never have been realized back, for example, when Decatur was taking your water out of Peachtree Creek.
Right. So the photos in the book are really great.
Thank you.
What kind of camera setup did you use, and how did you go about hauling that with you in a canoe?
Well, a lot of the photos, especially the more dramatic ones, were taken with a 4x5 view camera. And that didn't go in a canoe.
Yeah.
I did, at one point in my life, try to put a 4x5 in a canoe in a lake in North Georgia. And I'll never do that again. I took one into a glacier, too, in Greenland. But that was something else I'll never do again. Choose your format carefully. So the 4x5, obviously, I'd find sites that were of interest, and I'd really kind of study them and find the right time, and maybe go back and photograph them more than once, different seasons. And, that was my really artistic focus on this project. A lot of the other photographs, for example, canoeing, was shot 35mm film. Typically used transparencies, which wasn't always a good choice because of the lighting conditions. So that was pretty much it. And some of the very latest, there might be one or two digital images in there, but I'd say all of the shot all of them.
Interesting.
And it also sounds like you met a lot of people, like you had a lot of just good luck in people that you happened to meet along the way. Like, you met that former DeKalb County judge who had the dam dynamited. Like,
right.
What a coincidence.
It's amazing. You know, you just bump into people. And not all the stories made it in here. One of my favorites is down off of between Cheshire Bridge and Lenox, the South Forks comes through. I was down there with a friend, and we bumped into this guy who was a Rastafarian who had bicycled from Montana.
Wow.
On a, as he put it, a physical and spiritual journey across America. And it was kind of a trip. You can imagine this guy from, he showed us pictures of his white militia friends from Montana.
Wow.
The Rastafarian.
Yeah. It was kind of strange.
That is strange, but...
But and I thought your conversations that you included with some of the homeless folks that you met were really great too, because I mean, it really serves to humanize homeless people. A lot of people kind of dehumanize homeless people, and so I thought that was really interesting.
That's like anything else. There's a lot of othering that goes on. They sort of become statistics. They sort of become those people,
right?
And
you make a very good point. The really. Even my own stereotypes, I found myself throwing away as I went into this, and just engage somebody and talk to them. Not everybody has the same capabilities or means or circumstances. So, just to cast somebody off, just to, take the board scene perspective.
Yeah.
Is pretty narrow.
What would you say your favorite location along the creek was?
I'd have to go back to the Decatur Waterworks.
Yeah.
It's got everything. It's got ruins, it's got hiking trails, it's got the creek, people you bump into.
We tried to go there last weekend because we're kind of into, exploring abandoned places and doing photos and everything. And the one day we planned to go out somewhere is when it actually rains. And so I was torn because I was like, well, I'm mad because it ruined our plans, but I feel like I should be really grateful for the rain.
Yeah.
Well,
it sounds like it's not going anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. And that's another thing, how it's managed. It's 80 acres of property that's owned by DeKalb County. How it's managed not to have been developed over the years is a mystery to me.
Yeah. And I think that's a historical place that maybe a lot of people don't know about. I mean, I don't know. Maybe people who grew up here know about it, but I didn't know about
it. It's kind of a mix.
Well, it's kind of stuff back in the woods, too.
There's no signs.
Yeah. It's kind of a mix, you were saying?
Oh, just of you know, ruins and history and the terrain, trails. It's a great urban park in and of itself.
Yeah.
You mentioned that some of the photos from this book are up at the Atlanta History Center. This is before we were talking on the podcast. When did that happen, and how long have they been there? How long will they be there?
So there's an exhibition of photographs from the book, about 20 prints, a number of them are 30 by 40 inches, so you really get the full perspective of the originals. And it's been up there, I guess, since the middle of the summer, and I'm negotiating with them now as to when it comes down, maybe the end of the year.
Yeah.
It was at the Fernbank 2-3 years ago with the Fernbank Museum for about 6 months, and then actually spent about a year and a half at the Science Center. So it's had a lot of public exposure. Never having had an exhibition before, I was happy that I could keep this one in the forefront. As a photographer, you can appreciate that.
Well, I just had some photos in my very first show, too.
Cool.
So, yeah.
That's
fine. Do you have anything else? Well, you want to give people the details about the book and where they can find it?
Yeah, it's list on it is $34.95, and it's available through UGA Press, Amazon, Borders, all of the standard outlets. And it's done very well, and I wouldn't wait too long because they're selling much faster than the publisher had thought. Hopefully they'll make it through Christmas. And good news, bad news, as long as everybody gets one.
Well, thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
The song you heard in this podcast was Flux by Drop Trio, available only on Magnatune.com.
Thanks for listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network. Visit us at gapodcastnetwork.com. If you have a question, comment, or drunken rant, leave us a voicemail by calling 678-389-9441. Who knows, it might be featured in a podcast. You can also email us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com.